I want to share a video with you, which of course is great for a podcast, but we'll put the link in the show notes. So tell me here, what can you see? It's paused. What can you see?
Looks like a rock, a pretty green rock.
Let me hit play.
Okay, I'm both fascinated, horrified, and full of admiration. That is an octopus.
Remember a little while back we heard about the fungi-inspired technology being useful for possible human missions to Mars. Do you remember
that? Yes, biology as an inspiration for solving problems, bio-inspiration, and its cousin, biomimicry, using biological models to solve complex problems here on Earth with we humans.
Because nature has had about 3.5 billion years to work on some seriously big problems. I think there's probably a bit we could learn, right? Today, we're learning about standing out and hiding away, and we're learning from cephalopods, octopus, cuttlefish, and squid.
Cephalopods and bioinspiration are what matter today on Discovery Matters.
My name is Dan Wilson, and I'm a senior scientist at the Costas Research Institute at Northeastern University.
So Dan's research zeroes in on the octopus's remarkable ability to adapt its appearance and the potential uses that that could have in human technology.
On our university's innovation campus, we look broadly at how we can borrow from both the materials and the mechanisms of how color and pattern are formed and controlled in nature. And one of the most exciting examples that nature provides is cephalopods and cephalopod coloration. So these animals are unmatched in their ability to change their appearance, whether that's for camouflage, for defense, for signaling with potential mates. The combination of material components that are embedded in the animal's body and its ability to manipulate many different components of its body at the same time is what makes it such an impressive example and source of inspiration for material scientists. So in our lab, we actually make the same colorant that is found in the skin of squid, octopus, and cuttlefish. It's a small molecule colorant called xanthomatin. And previous work with this material has shown that it can change color in response to different environmental stimuli outside of the animal. And we basically found that we could create color changes with this natural material in paints in response to sunlight. We typically don't focus on the biology. We think about how we can use the materials and integrate them into more complex systems to create technologies for us and for the real world.
What spurred Dan and his team to study cephalopods? Was it a specific problem, or was this an example of sudden revelation or serendipity?
I've worked with cephalopod-inspired materials for a few years in collaboration with some folks on the Northeastern Maine campus. But this project actually came about because one of our research programs in our lab is focused on making more eco-friendly and health-conscious paints. So we had originally started investigating the utility of xanthomatin, this material from cephalopod skin, as a natural colorant that we could potentially use to replace some legacy colorants that have been in paints forever. And when we started to build those formulations to understand what colors we could create, we saw that there were some changes happening in our formulations under certain stimuli that we were using to test the environmental durability of the paints. And that's what really kicked this off and how we started seeing if we could fine-tune these color changes to cover a broader color palette.
Maybe one day we're going to sit at easels and paint pictures of octopi using these paints.
So meta, you could envision a kaleidoscope of colors on your canvas because the color you begin with could change.
in cephalopods, these colorants are found in organs called chromatophores, which are typically yellow or brown or red. And the color of a chromatophore depends on the oxidation state of xanthomatin when it's inside the animal. So in the oxidized form, the pigment is yellow, and in the reduced form, it's red. Our paints that we created in this effort are redox active. So when we shine light on them, we can drive electrons towards xanthomatin to make it shift from a yellow color or an initial tan hue towards something that looks redder or more pink. We have shown that we can create transient and dynamic artwork, where if we apply these coatings through different masks, we're able to create art that appears with light, but that also disappears over time. So we can imagine that our paint is like a reusable canvas where we can project any pattern onto that surface. Over the course of about one day, that color will dissipate and you can re-irradiate on a new day to create new art. The other thing that we've discussed is using these as materials that could allow color change that's dependent on the weather. So maybe if you have outdoor artwork, or you imagine that you want your home or your car to change colors, depending on the environment it's in, these materials and formulations can support that as well.
It's just fascinating to see how nature's mechanisms can inspire practical solutions in so many different applications and industries. There are some similarities to Dan's work already going on in the paint industry.
They're often in novelty spaces like color-changing toys or color-changing clothing. And in some applications, there are also materials that enable transmittance changes like electrochromic coatings for windows. What's unique about this is how little energy our system requires to undergo color change, and that we're able to capitalize on the energy of the sun and use sunlight as ambient stimulus that we'll generally always have access to drive these optical changes that we're excited to show. So we don't rely on thermochromism. We don't have to make these surfaces hot, and we don't have to build in any circuitry or electronics. We can keep this as a really simple one coat coating formulation that you can apply over a surface and it works.
Titanium dioxide comes into play here, which I think many people may be familiar with as a chemical in commercial coatings.
Titanium dioxide is broadly employed in virtually all coating formulations as a hiding pigment. So it really effectively scatters light and allows us to hide the underlying substrate. So when we paint over something, we can't see that surface that we just painted over. It's really, really effective at that. But TiO2 is also a semiconductor and is used for certain energy applications and solar cell formulations. So there are dye-sensitized solar cells where there are small molecule dyes or colorants that are layered over the top of TiO2, and those are actually used to create energy. What we found in this study was that TiO2 basically acts as a source of electrons or a facilitator of this electronic process, where it can drive electrons into xanthomatin to perform this reversible photoreduction that we see.
Dan's work not only sheds light on innovative paint technology, but it also underscores the importance of energy-efficient sunlight-driven technology.
Our paints are most responsive in the UV region, and that is based on the electronic properties of the titanium dioxide and when it is most prone to facilitating movement of electrons that ultimately drive color changes in the pigments that are incorporated into the formulation. So within that UV space, and that was ultimately because of the penetration depth and the ability of the light to get through the actual bulk paint matrix, the actual film.
What brought Dan to this field and the wacky world of cephalopods?
I started in this area as a postdoctoral associate at Northeastern University before I moved over to this independent position at the Costas Research Institute in Burlington. I had previously worked in diagnostics and microfluidics, making low-cost diagnostics and systems for the point of care. And what I've started to do now is see how those things can come together, where we draw from the design requirements for resource-limited settings, thinking we need something that can function in a place that has no electricity, no running water, minimally trained users, and take those principles and put them together with some of the performance capabilities of bio-inspired systems to create devices or techniques for creating devices that could cause these changes for different application spaces, but do so in a way that's really effective.
We've stumbled into a field which is right in our wheelhouse, where we are in our comfort zone. So does Dan see any potential application for this in diagnostics? I mean, I love the idea that he's thinking about low resource settings where energy and training are normally limited.
Constraining resources really drives innovation. We've seen it time and time again. When you don't have much, you're forced to innovate. And in this case, it's bringing some extra color to diagnostics.
Color is one of the most valuable outputs that we can create for those environments because it's interpretable by eye. So you don't have to have a secondary reader. There's not necessarily a requirement for electronics. Or if you want to bring in maybe a camera phone to measure color intensity from a readout zone in a device, that's really practical to do because then the electronics are ubiquitous. So I'm excited to think about xanthomatin and other bio-inspired colorants that could potentially be built into diagnostic or analytical sequences where we get some color formation or performance feature out of the aggregate system that we didn't have before. So any of the color metric indicators for maybe enzyme activity or chelating heavy metals, maybe for environmental monitoring, we can think about how we can do those things too, but maybe expand their performance or look at new analytes or new areas by using these materials for detection.
It is wonderful to imagine all the ambient stimuli these materials could respond to. It's like living color.
It's brilliant, isn't it? And I can almost imagine clothing that might change color to signal poor air quality. I just couldn't resist ending the interview by geeking out and going a bit science fiction-y, but then asking Dan if he had a favorite cephalopod. And of course, he does.
I think the cuttlefish may be my favorite cephalopod because of the hypnosis performance features for hunting. So in cephalopods, the color features are layered vertically through the depth of the skin. So you have all the molecular absorbers, the chromatophores up at the top, and then you have iridescence and white light coming from structural elements down at the bottom. So a cuttlefish will flash its absorptive features over its backlights, basically, its features that create white underneath, and hypnotize prey before it eats them, which is a really interesting thing to watch if you've never seen it.
What is your favorite cephalopod, Connor?
It's the blanket octopus. And the reason is it's the females have been observed using the stinging tentacles of the Portuguese man of war jellyfish as defense weapons. So they're super smart. They're smart enough to understand not only tool use, but they can connect the use of a tool with a specific capability or property and use that in action against predators. That is some proper complex thinking.
Well, I picked a favorite as well. And I'm not sure that mine is aggressive because I quite like the look of the Dumbo octopus. They are inspired by the Disney character with his huge ears because the Dumbo octopus, and there are 15 different species, but they're all considered Dumbo octopuses. It just looks like they have huge, big Dumbo ears. Their legs are all attached like duck feet, but they live super, super deep in the water. They can live as far down as 7,000 meters. What a resilient life form.
Anyway, our next guest has a favourite octopus. He's focused on quite a small but peppy little creature.
My name is Alon Gorodetsky. I'm an associate professor of chemical and biomolecular engineering at the University of California, Irvine.
Alon's research focuses on the marvelous little blue-ringed octopus. They're super poisonous, one of the world's most venomous marine animals, but even though it's really small, it can carry enough venom to kill 26 adult humans in minutes, so it's a real inspiration here.
It must be said that video you showed me at the top of our episode was in fact a blue-ringed octopus.
This specific little blue-ringed octopus really caught the attention of myself and members of my group because it's covered in these bright blue rings that remind you of a halogen lamp in some way. And it has those rings because it's an extremely poisonous little animal. You really do not want to be bitten by this octopus. And so those rings are telling people they're, rather than camouflage, they're almost a signal. And anything that comes near it, it's saying, hey, I'm a bright blue sign that says, don't touch me, don't eat me. That signaling capability is what we tried to emulate, to draw inspiration from for the design of our devices.
Dodi, have you heard of these dielectric elastomer actuator?
We do not discuss that at our dinner table, no.
You're not alone. A dielectric elastomer actuator, or DEA, it's a type of material that changes shape when an electrical voltage is applied to it, and it works in a similar way to our muscles. Alon and his team designed one that was inspired by the octopus.
Effectively, you have this sandwich type structure where you have an electrode on top, an electrode on the bottom, and the dielectric elastomer layer in the middle. And then you apply a very large voltage between the two electrodes. So it's a sandwich or capacitor type structure. And there is a mechanical change that takes place where the area of the device expands. So effectively there's a force, it's kind of like squishing a sandwich and then seeing it expand out the sides. And so that's the effect of taking a voltage and then changing it into a mechanical output in very broad and accessible terms. So that's effectively how dielectric elastomer actuator works.
So how does Alon's device resemble the octopus's color changing ability?
We've used these types of devices primarily for experiments in the infrared. In this sandwich type configuration, we essentially think of the dielectric elastomer layer as the meat, and we essentially added a dye that can be blue and brown as a layer of cheese, if you will, on top of the meat. By patterning that dye to look like this blue ring on a brown background, we could achieve an effect where the intensity of the blue would change as the dielectric elastomer actuator expanded. And the same thing would happen to the brown, but to a lesser degree. And that is very similar to how these blue-brown rings on the skin of the octopus function, because there's also muscular action that serves to increase the contrast and almost hide or reveal these blue rings. Now, it's not a direct analogy because we use the dye to achieve the color, whereas the animal uses a combination of structural color and also a dye or dyes to achieve a similar effect. So it's more bioinspiration rather than biomimicry.
Cool, huh? The octopus uses these tiny muscles to change the shape of the chromatophores, which is part of how it changes its skin color instantaneously. And Alon's DEA sort of does the same thing.
Are these dyes like the chemicals in the octopus's skin, or are they entirely different?
They're quite different. They have some very basic similarities, but it was a very special dye that Alon and his team designed. It's from a class of compounds called acenes, and the design of this dye had to be really stable so it could be incorporated into the device, and the large voltage that you need to apply to the DEA to function didn't disrupt it.
What is the impact of the long-term use of high voltage on the device?
The actuation is fairly aggressive because you're applying this large voltage and then you're seeing this mechanical effect where the device expands and gets thinner. And for our devices, we've been able to cycle them more than 1,000 times typically with no issues. And that's one of the hallmarks of using the types of materials that we have. Now, the interesting part for using this dye is that these devices have a very well-defined set of ways that they fail. So one of them is pinhole shorts, or effectively just make a tiny little hole, and then the device fails, stops functioning. Now, what we were very surprised to find is in our case, the devices seem to self-repair. So you would still make a tiny little hole, you could see it burn out, but then something would happen to the dye, the device, where it would almost plug that hole. And then they would resume operating without you having to do anything. And that was a very, very surprising finding.
So amazing, right? Color changing and partially self-healing. And of course, super sci-fi.
Fascinating. But what are the practical applications?
It's very, very early research. It's important to stress this, but there are multiple possible uses for DEAs like this, whether we're talking about dynamic displays or warning systems.
These dielectric elastomer actuators have often been touted for a large range of areas. And for our purposes, what we've really focused on is camouflage and signaling and deception. We're not quite at the technology translation stage yet, but there are some potential applications that you can definitely see. So for example, the stability of this dye, the very high stability under light when you're effectively applying large voltages across the film of it, even if it's not directly conducting, that really lends itself to displays and displays that would flash, for example, to warn someone, and ones that would be soft, conformable, that you could apply to something like a sheet of paper or a flexible plastic film and then not worry about it. That's one potential application. If you've got flashing signs that are very stable and easy to apply, the applications almost write themselves. But I think that's further off. There's certainly additional technological development that we would need to do. I think from a camouflage perspective, the large voltages, or even from a deception perspective, are a major limitation that has not been effectively overcome by anyone yet. And we're talking on the range of kilovolts. So that is a problem that definitely needs to be solved in a fairly elegant way.
There are so many ways that we can still learn from cephalopods, especially the octopus.
It seems like this bioinspiration could go beyond signaling and camouflage. And I mean, they're such fascinating beings, so dexterous, intelligent. But there's also this, I mean, as you said, this science fiction-y kind of feeling. What else can they teach us?
The ability of an octopus limb to stretch or to twist, to pick things up, to grasp, it's fairly unique and different from how we do things terrestrially. That's driving a lot of soft robotics research, where there's a constant push towards making soft body robots that would have the same strength and manual dexterity of an octopus. There's also a big push towards understanding the neurophysiology of these animals, how they can take this vast amount of information from their surroundings and instantaneously transfer that into copying the appearance of their surroundings. And the processing power to make that happen has to be amazing.
This fusion of biology and engineering is going to pave the way for lots of transformative technologies. It's remarkable research, and as it so often is, it's being driven by strong collaborators working across multiple fields and lots of up and coming talent.
I always try to underscore is you can have these ideas and these concepts, but a lot of the work is really driven by the dedication of the students. So I give a lot of the credit to my students who really fought to get this work done. And I had some very talented students, Chingyi Shu and Preeta Pratakshya and David Dibble, who really worked very carefully on different aspects of the project. It was a team interdisciplinary effort. Speaking of interdisciplinarity, the other colleague that I have to give credit to is my collaborator, Sahar, at Boston University. And she and her students were very instrumental for providing computational guidance as we went through this process. It's a lot more cost-effective and rewarding to predict something before you do it, or to be able to explain it very well after you observe it. And I think that's a really important piece of the puzzle.
Today, we discovered the fascinating world of cephalopods, and I urge you to go look at the show notes and explore some of the videos and the illustrations, because these creatures have incredible adaptive powers, which can lead to bioinspiration. We can expect paint that reacts to light, warning systems inspired by the blue ring octopus. I mean, it's shapeshifters. For real.
It's extraordinary. So from warning signs to pollution responsive clothing, the possibilities are endless. Dan's research is also possibly instrumental in creating diagnostic devices, again, in resource limited settings, as we've discussed on a recent episode as well, and it has a potential to transform lives. So the way in which cephalopods camouflage and communicate could really shape a lot of industries in the future.
Every day is a school day. So, Connor, what have you learned recently?
I was so tempted to come back with another cephalopod fact, but that would just not be right. But I have to just drop this one in. I learned that they're actually colorblind. So go figure, right? How colorful they are, but they can't see color. And so what are they doing changing color the whole time? Anyhow, I learned this week, and you may have seen it in the news, it was published in the Royal Society of Biological Sciences, that attention deficit hyperactivity disorder may have its genetic origins as an evolutionary advantage linked to exploring while foraging. So the idea that in our hunter-gatherer societies, a proclivity to explore whilst foraging for berries and food and what have you would lead to more success evolutionarily. So it's very interesting that something that potentially today is seen as a limitation.
Or a challenge,
yes, may have actually evolved evolutionarily as a distinct advantage for groups. So it's a fantastic study. You can go and read it on the Royal Society website.
Nice perspective. What I learned does have to do with this episode's topic, cephalopod, or rather it was inspired. Because, yes, in Greek, cephalopod means feet head. And so I started thinking about feet, and I saw a study recently published in National Geographic about whether or not we should keep our shoes on when we're in the house. What kind of crap do feet bring into a home?
Oh, so interesting and culturally important for our, like,
that's it.
World.
Correct.
Swedes and Japanese, shoes off. Brits, we don't care. Mud everywhere.
That's right. New Zealand, shoes off. We know that it is common in Germany to have a pair of indoor shoes and you leave your outdoor shoes outdoors. But more than etiquette, what is the scientific proof that it's a good idea to take your shoes off? And of course, when you're walking outdoors, what do the soles of your shoes pick up? All kinds of pathogens and foreign material. So basically, the science says, yeah, your shoes gather a lot of crap, and it's best to leave those micrograms of dog poo or what.
Leave the poop at the door whilst you come in.
Right.
It's like as you wander into the saloon, you put your weapons in the door, at the door. Leave your poopy shoes at the door.
That's it. I quite enjoyed that National Geographic thought, let's get some data behind this cultural practice.
Mm-hmm. Our producer is Beth Armit Brewster, editing and mixing and supervision by Banda Productions. Music from Epidemic Sound. My name is Connor McKechnie.
And I'm Dodi Axelson. Please do give us a rating on Spotify or wherever you are listening from. We'll be back soon with another episode of Discovery Matters.